I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
It's so friggin' early for me. Holy shit.
Oh, yeah, you're in California, so thank you very much for getting up early. I appreciate that, man.
Oh, no problem, no.
You are, like, the busiest man on the planet.
That's what they say.
This is my guess about you, Kenny Aronoff, that you have, through your many connections, have somehow cloned yourself, and there's, like, four of you. And there's the guy that does sessions in the studio. There's the guy that plays live. There's the guy that takes care of the family. And there's the guy that's now writing all the books. I think that's your secret. You can tell me now. That's it, right?
That's so funny. I do have an identical twin brother that lives.
That's true. That's how you do it.
Yeah. Well, the only problem is he's a doctor and he isn't much of a drummer. But we grew up in Western Mass, you know, in the Berkshires.
Yeah.
So John still lives there, Dr. John.
Nice.
And he still lives there. But we played in bands together. We were, like, both on varsity sports teams when we were in high school. So, like, there'd be one, well, we both had long hair, believe it or not, back then, down to our shoulders. So we'd play lacrosse and soccer. We'd be in the same field, freak everybody out. There'd be two of us. You know what I'm saying?
That's awesome. Yeah.
One time I had him when I was doing an arena tour with Bob Seger. I had him sit on the drum set, and that, you know, everybody instantly knew it wasn't me.
When he started playing, right?
Yeah, he didn't play that. I know.
Is funny. In your book, you talk about that, like sending him backstage into rooms full of people, and
The funniest one was, I'm on stage, and John's out in the audience for Mellencamp, sold out ABC concert in Indiana, and people are coming up to him and says, "Hey, are you Kenny Aronoff?" My brother goes, "Well, if I'm Kenny Aronoff, who the hell's up on the drums right now playing?" What? That's the most ignorant shit I ever heard. That's what happened to me when I was in Nashville, but this is even weirder. Some girl, I'm there watching Tool in Nashville, and, you know, Maynard, I get sometimes mixed, you know, people go, "Are you Maynard?" You know, the singer from Tool.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. No, I can see that, yeah.
So, some girl go, "Hey, are you Maynard?" This is before the show. I said, "No, I'm not." I'm bald like him. Says, "You're Maynard, aren't you?" I said, "No, I'm not." I'm just, okay, show starts. Maynard's on stage. "You're Maynard, aren't you?"
I'm oh, like, my God.
If I'm fucking Maynard, how can I be singing on stage, be standing here talking to you? And that's I want to say a few other things with that accent, you can imagine.
Well, Jesus. Let me ask you from there. So is the band Tool one of, like, the handful of artists you have not played drums for yet?
That's for sure, but I sure would. I love that band. Yeah. No, I have not played with Tool. That's a handful.
Yeah.
That's one of the bands that kind of slipped through my fingers.
Well, they have a pretty good drummer, too, you know.
Yeah, you know, Danny, God, he's damn good. He's really good.
But you,
great guy, too.
You know, people listening now, I have to say, there's a 90% chance that you have heard Kenny playing drums, whether it's on the radio or on a record or whatever you were listening to. There's a good chance you've heard Kenny playing the drums, because you really, literally have played with everybody. The list of people you played with goes on for pages, like pages pages.
I had to come up with some stats, because I have a speaking business now, and, you know, you got to put some stats on there for people who don't know the name Kenny Aronoff, and also for the book. And this is without downloads. I'm on over 300 million records sold.
Oh, my God.
And 1,300 gold, platinum, diamond records, 60 nominated to win Grammys. that's the best I can do. I mean, it's really hard to find that those numbers out because it's harder and harder because, you know, it's like, it's not, that information is not available like it used to be.
Yeah.
I have so many, oh man, I mean, some people listening, I mean, I'll give you two scenarios. There was a time when in 1991, when I did Blaze of Glory with Bon Jovi, 2 weeks in the studio, walked out, next 2 days, did Elton John. Next 4 days, I did Bob Seger. Then I flew to Atlanta to do the Indigo Girls in Athens for about 4 or 5 days. Flew back. I had to take the red eye, by the way, to go through the night to get there. Then I flew back, did 4 more days with Seger, then I did Willie Nelson. That was my life. It just kept going and going. Yeah. I had 2 drum sets in Nashville, 2 in LA, 2 in New York. I had some overseas. I had another scenario is, 12 o'clock to 6 o'clock, I was rehearsing with John Fogerty, and it was the first time he was doing his Creedence catalog. And then I would get in the car, and I'd drive, you know, a half hour to another studio where I was working with Roy Bittan from the Springsteen band. He was producing an artist from Boston, actually. Her name was Katie, forget her last name. But then from 7 to 11, then from midnight to 5 in the morning, I was recording with the Rolling Stones. And then, on the weekend, Bon Jovi. John Bon Jovi.
Oh my
God. That was
my
life. That was just, another day in Kenny's. You know, sometimes I have 3 drum sets scattered around a town.
Is that what your schedule's still like now, or how long did you keep that up? Because I know you'd play with someone, and then on your off days you would fly somewhere.
Yeah,
And how long? Like, how do you maintain that as a drummer, which is very physical?
Yeah.
Well,
some of it's genetics, and the other is that I started practicing 8 hours a day when I was 18. The day I graduated high school, I started practicing 8 hours a day, 7 days a week, actually from fear, because I had decided there was no, when I grew up, there was no, in Stockbridge, Massachusetts, there was nobody teaching rock and roll drums. And so I started, and there was no mentors of how to be a rock drummer. There was no school of rock. So I started studying with the percussionist from the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And my point is, to answer your question, I started training hard to, like a Marine, very young. And, and all that athleticism and training as a jock gave me it was familiar for me to push myself over the top. I'm touching on 2 things. One is I was trained to work over the top and to never give up. It's in my DNA also. And the point I'm getting at here is because I started studying with the percussionist from the Boston Symphony Orchestra, because Tanglewood was 3 hours from my house, I got my ass kicked by Arthur Press. And basically, and this is, I'm jumping around here, but when I wrote my book, I came up with 7 ways I believe people can be successful. The book I'm writing now is about those 7 ways, but I always thought I was going to put that in my first book, but I left out 300 pages of sessions and things in the existing book, Sex, Drums, Rock and Roll. I did so much, and the publisher said, man, it's getting boring. And then I did this, and then I played with God. Then I went on tour with Jesus, and then I went out with... I mean, it's like, all right, we already know you've done everything. And then I flew to Mars, and then I went to Jupiter. All right, so we cut out a lot of stuff, and I went, well, I'm going to write the next book, and this book is about, are you living your life loud, or are you dying on the vine? I mean, how I got to that was, I thought, well, why was I wanting to work so hard? Everyone's partying when they graduate college. I went my first year to UMass in Amherst, Massachusetts, exit 4, near Springfield, and I was like, why are you practicing this? Because I was afraid to fail. I was afraid to... I had told everybody, I'm going to college, I'm going to be a music major, I'm a musician, and I went, shit, I'm not that good. I'm not really that good. I was like, oh my God, I got to practice, I got to work my ass off. And I literally, for 5 years, I've just spent my whole life trying to feel like be great. And I have a saying, I'll never be as great as I want to be, but I'll spend the rest of my life trying to be as great as I can be. It's in my DNA. When Jack and Diane went to number one, in about 2 seconds, I was like, oh my God, can I do this again? Will I be able to do this again? Oh my God, everyone thinks I'm number one. I got this drum solo that's still played on the, that song still played on the radio.
Oh yeah.
35 years
everywhere.
Later.
Yeah.
Oh my God. I mean, I think it was as if I knew that was going to happen. And when I've got to stay great. Or how do you practice to be great at something like that? Simple drum beats on radio. I didn't know. I was really like perplexed and really had a lot of fear. And my point is that fear to me to be great and to stay great was like, if I don't do this, I just as well die. So that's where I came up with the whole thing. Are you living your life or are you dying in this life? I mean, and essentially we're all dying physically, but man, God damn it. You fucking lazy and entitled motherfuckers, get off your fucking butt. I don't give a fuck what you've gone through, this happened or that happened. Everybody's got excuse. Everybody's been through hell at some point. Some people are luckier than others. But man, if you just waste your life, you are not only letting yourself down, but you're letting everybody down. You're letting society down because you're not taking care of yourself. If you don't take care of yourself, somebody has to take care of your lazy fucking ass. Now, I mean, I get that hardcore about it. I mean, now if you got both your legs shot off when you're in Iraq, that's a whole different story. But if you're capable and you're looking for an excuse to get by, fuck you or shame on you. I wouldn't have sworn, but you said I could. So
No, you're fine. But, yeah, absolutely.
But the thing is, you get what I'm saying. I mean,
yeah. Oh yeah.
Come on, man. You know this is like you're not just. It's not all about you, buddy.
Yeah.
You're letting everybody down.
Well,
you're wasting your life. You're literally saying, "Oh, I'm going to spend my entire life dying while I'm alive."
Right.
What the fuck is that? I know I'm being very hardcore, but that's kind of what I've turned it into.
Well, you have to be because time is the most precious commodity, and you only have limited time. So I know what you're saying. Don't waste it. You know that you only have a limited booking on this planet. You know,
exactly.
So make it happen. I understand that. And you mentioned luck earlier. And how much I know you work so hard and you're so disciplined from just reading about you and watching you play and stuff. But how much is luck involved? Because in the business, in the music business, there's no formula. It's like you're here today, you're gone tomorrow, or something, some kind of fluke will keep you around for a few years. So how much do you think in your career, with all the people you played with, how much is that luck or right place, right time?
Very, very little.
Yeah.
You know, like I talk about, like, you know, I saw the Beatles when I was, that's how I'm starting off my new book. Well, right now, it's kind of, are you living your life loud? Are you dying on the vine? You know, I saw the Beatles when I was 11 years old on the Ed Sullivan Show. But here's my point, 50 years later, I'm playing with Paul and Ringo, honoring them for that TV show, the Ed Sullivan Show. So I'm saying 50 years later, my dreams came true. But they didn't happen by accident. I made it happen. The reason why I got the fucking call through the gig is I was still relevant. Every day, every moment of my life, trying to be great, led me to the 50 years later. So that I was so happy. There was only a few guys that this MD was going to call, and I was available, and I got the call. So I'm now playing with, and not only that, but I could handle it. I could run it, you know, doing 7 Kennedy honor shows playing, you know, Obama. I've learned how to be the guy that can do shows like that.
Yeah.
That don't make mistakes, that know how to write music, read music, all of the above. Point is, I believe you make your destiny. And, you know, I talk to businessmen that are successful. A lot of them have gotten their asses kicked like I did. A lot of them lost their money. A lot of them got scammed. It's the ones that come back and stand back up that become successful and stay successful. Everybody's going to get their asses kicked. Everybody's going to go through hell. It's a given, man, you guys. It's not like, woe is me. It's just your turn. That's all, man. It's part of life. But the cool thing is, and it's not cool when you're going through it, man, you got to look at those opportunities as the best and most important way to grow. Getting your ass kicked, it doesn't feel like it when you're going through it, but man, that's how you grow. So the next time you get your ass kicked, you're like, okay, this is where I am. I know what to do now. Well, think about this. Greatest running back in football. Does he score a touchdown every time? No, hell no. He gets his ass kicked. Sometimes he fumbles. Sometimes he does. He gets the ball five times and he goes 1 yard every time. And then he gets a touchdown. He wait at some point. Or one play, somebody sticks their helmet in the knee and breaks his knee. He's out for the season. He's got to rehabilitate, comes back. He's always looking to get into the end zone. I mean, that's just life, man. You're always trying to get in the end zone. And so great businessmen, great successful people, they make their destiny. Luck, okay, here's my luck maybe. Graduate from college, get into the Drews from Symphony Orchestra, played at Tanglewood. Took me 4 year attempts, as you saw in the book, to get into Tanglewood. Mm-hmm. I'd go to Symphony Hall in Boston every year for 4 years to audition for Vic Firth. Denied, denied, denied. Strike three, you're out. I went back again and got in. Seven percussionists out of the whole world get into this program. I get in. So I did great. And I go to graduate from college, 5 years of college, and I'm in the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra, and I say, I ain't going. Start all over again. You know, practicing 8 hours a day, 4 years trying to make it in music. Go to Indiana. Everybody back to Indiana, where I spent 4 years studying school, the number one classical music, the number one school in America at that time in classical music. And I go back there, and I'm living in a band house paying rent, $67 a month, you know, trying to get a record deal, be in a band and all this shit. All right, here's where the luck might have come in. I'm going to move to New York City, and then somebody tells me this guy, Johnny Cougar. Have you ever heard of this guy, Johnny Cougar? I went, yeah, I've seen him on this new TV show. It's called MTV.
Yeah.
And he's on the radio, and I'm like, oh, yeah. I wasn't really into his music back then. But then it suddenly dawned on me, oh, my God, that'd be like being in the Beatles. He's already making records, already touring. I went, shit. All right. I auditioned. All right, the luck is, I'm in Bloomington, Indiana, and this is where this guy lives. But I auditioned, and, you know, I made it happen. I auditioned, I practiced that record, and memorized every lick, the John Cougar record. Memorized every lick and every drum beat, and I won the audition. And so the luck is that I was in the same town as he was.
Yeah.
But that's about it.
That's
man.
It, though. That's the right place, right time thing.
Right time, right time.
Yeah,
I made it happen. And right. Here's the other thing: John asked everybody, "Who is there anybody in town that's good? You know, if you want to hire somebody that lived in town as opposed to bring somebody in from like L.A." Well, I made my destiny by everybody went, "You got to check out this guy, Kenny Earl. He's the baddest ass mofo," and it was because I built up a reputation from hard work. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Hard work and pushing it. Everybody was like, Kenny Earl's the shit. So I made my opportunities. That's what I'm saying.
Can you give me an example? I mean, you already gave the example of trying to get in the BSO, but when you really, really like got your ass kicked, like you had a job or you were playing live and it was like, holy shit, I'm really fucking up right now.
Well, yeah. What happened was after 5 weeks making it into John Cougar Mellencamp, and I was like, I was the happiest guy in the world. I finally got into a big band that was going to tour the world, that was already touring the world, that was making records, and we were going to L.A. to make a record in 5 weeks. I told everybody I was going to L.A., I was so pumped. I was so happy, and in 5 weeks when I got to L.A., I got dumped in 2 days. Because I didn't have the right gear, because I didn't know what the purpose of a drummer is for an artist like John Mellencamp to get his songs on the radio to be number one. I didn't know that. I didn't have the skill set. John would play a song on acoustic guitar, and he'd be looking for me to come up with ideas along with the other guys in the band to come up with great parts to make that song a number one hit. Well, I didn't have that skill set. I was trying to play more technical.
Right.
So, and the producer back then, there was no Pro Tools, so you had to be able to play a song from the beginning to end with perfect time,
right.
perfect groove, perfect parts,
yeah.
not fuck up. Everything had to be just perfect. Your sound, your groove, there was no punching in. Well, there was punching in, but they didn't want you to punch in. They wanted you to get full takes. And I still play like that. When people send me files to me to record drums on in my home studio, I give 3 takes, complete full takes, no edits, from beginning to end. Everything's perfect, you know, the vibe, the sound, the feel. Anyway, my point is, I was not that guy yet. No matter what, if I played with Leonard Bernstein and Aaron Copland and the BSO and all this stuff, I wasn't that guy yet. So my point is, John pulls me into a room at the Chateau Marmont Hotel, and we'll have a band meeting. He's basically telling me, you're not going to play on the record. You go back to Indiana. I told him, I'm not going back to Indiana. I went, no, not going back. I said, I'm not going to go back. I was mortified. And so I scrambled on my feet to come up with an answer that would, you know, that would be beneficial to the both of us. And I went, I'm scrambling. I mean, I'm shooting from the hip. And I finally went, well, you know, I'm still your drummer, right? And he goes, well, yeah. What are you getting at? I went, well, I'm going to stay here. And I'm going to go in the studio and watch these other session drummers play on my songs, play my beats, and I'll learn from them. And I'll get better, and then I'll benefit from that. And then you'll benefit from me getting better because I'm your drummer. And you don't have to pay me. I'll sleep on the floor. I just ain't going home. And he said, well, all right. And I'm sure that don't pay me with the deal breaker for him.
Right.
And I did learn, and I did go back, and I set up a regimen of 8 hours a day, started lifting weights heavy, and, you know, running 6 miles a day, decided to become a vegetarian, really lean out, really get focused, stop drinking, you know, just even, I mean, I never was a heavy drinker, I'm just, so I really went Marine style.
Yeah.
This was a pinnacle moment of my life. I went, I do not want to lose this, I do not want to lose my place in this band, I want to make records, and my goal was to make the next record. It took a year and a half before we even started the next record. Most difficult record I've ever made in my life. 2 guys got fired. John and I almost got a fist fight.
Whoa.
John was in shit mood. John, I didn't realize, but this record, if it wasn't good, John was going to be dropped again.
Wait. Was this the one with Jack and Diane on it?
Yes.
And that's the most difficult record you've ever made out of all the work
yes.
you've done. Really?
And it was it won 2 Grammys. And for the listeners, that was the record that launched my career.
Yeah.
And the most difficult. We were in a studio. Jack and Diane was off the record. Gone. We didn't know what to do with it. We didn't know how to present that song so that it was the way it is now. And the song was off the album. That's why John was frustrated. He almost died in a motorcycle crash. It was just hell on wheels. Every
wow.
day felt like a week. Every week felt like a month. It was not fun. And so John... one day, the Bee Gees were recording next to us in this studio in Miami, and John kept hearing, or we kept hearing these sounds next door, like a drum machine or a drum program. And so John was like, what the fuck is that? And one day, the producer, Don Gates, co-producer, came in with this Lin 1 drum machine. And I'm like, what the fuck is that? Immediately, it immediately triggered the fear of being replaced again.
Right, right.
And it just triggered that, right? So I grabbed that thing. Well, God damn it. Well, let me program at least so I can be part of the song. So I basically programmed my beat. And, you know, I had the manual out, and I was learning how to do it, you know, how to... You know, back then, these drum machines were new, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And,
yeah, very primitive.
So it was, yeah, so it was a whole new thing. So I grabbed this thing, and I start, you know, programming it, and then I go back into the lounge and play and pull them all bummed out. Fucking drum machine. I'm being replaced
yeah.
by a drum machine. How insulting. So then I get a call, like, Aronoff, John wants to see you. And I get a, hey, fucker, you know, we need a drum solo. I'm thinking, drum solo on a ballad? I'm thinking, God, what would Buddy Rich say? He'd say, this song sucks. Get rid of it. So, Well, so we spent like about, oh God, we must have spent, you know, all day getting drum sounds. For the people listening, man, the drums used to be recorded in vocal booths, small rooms, so they could control the sound, and you and they weren't used to this big drum sound like that John Bonham got, you know, on the Zeppelin records. What they did was they put the John's goal. I love this about John. I mean, man, he was the most competitive motherfucker. That's why the both of us were so perfect for each other. We pushed each other to almost getting in fist fights. You know, we were really competitive. You know, I still dig him for that. And so anyway, John said, I want our songs on this record to blow up, be more powerful and louder than any other song on the radio. So any song that comes on the radio before us gets beaten down and dwarfed, and any song that comes on the radio after us gets beaten down and dwarfed.
Yes, yeah.
And you know what? The songs that were big back then, Ebony and Ivory by Michael Jackson with Paul McCartney, Ebony and Ivory, and then Eye of the Tiger, which was powerful, but not like when Hurt So Good came on.
Right.
We did, the drums were so loud, and then the guitars, you know, it was like, like, fuck you, motherfucker. And boy, I swore more in your eye on your podcast than I usually swear.
That's okay. Because, that's okay.
I just want you guys to know I love you in Boston. I'm a huge I'm a big Patriots fan, big
awesome.
Celtics fan. I'm a big Bruins fan. I'm a big Red Sox fan. Anyway, so I'm a Massachusetts boy. Anyway, so so you know, and it worked. We did the AC/DC thing. AC/DC has minimal instruments playing simple parts, and when you do that, every instrument sounds very loud. You can mix it very loud. Anyway, point is, now I got to come up with a drum part. And to make a long story short, I started off, you know, with this boom, blam entrance, and then I tried some things. Next thing you know, the story is this: I'm in a control room. Everyone's saying, "You should try this. You should try this. You should try this. You should try this." Meanwhile, I'm thinking, "Fuck! Bottom line is, I got to go out there and save the day, or I'm going to be fired again." And I'm walking out there, going, "Fuck! What are you going to play, Kenny?" I'm like, "You got 40 feet to save your career." And I'm walking out, shit, 30 feet. 25, 20, what are you going to play? And I'm like, I don't know. I can't, what the fuck am I going to play? 5 feet, 1 feet. I turn around and I'm like, holy shit, I'm looking at a room of 9 or 8 people in a room looking at me like waiting. But what am I going to play? I'm shit. I sit down and go, and something popped into my head. I went, fuck. I'll play the same thing I'm playing, which I went up the drums. Everybody goes down the drums, so I'm trying to be different. And maybe it was all my schooling and education. It was definitely all my life experiences up until that moment that gave me something that made me say, play that same beat, but just start it 1/8 note later. So instead of boom, blam, one, I went boom, blam, one, And that's the rhythm that I'd been, that was programmed in the drum machine I was stealing for myself. John puts down the buzzers, hit a cymbal. I hit a cymbal, then I go down the drums. And then I do a triplet, and all of a sudden, old Jed's a millionaire.
Yeah.
John has now got a hit record. It was Mick Ronson from Bowie's band that was visiting us, giving us some input, said, you know, you should have Kenny play a beat and play the chorus over it. And bam, we had a number one hit. We didn't know it, though, because let me tell you something. At the end of 9 weeks of recording, I thought I'd gone to Vietnam and came back, and I thought, damn, I'm done.
Yeah.
I did it. 2 weeks later, I remember I flew to Massachusetts to visit my mom. We were in Northampton with me with my girlfriend hanging out, just taking it easy, and I get a call from John. Aronoff, we're not done.
What?
We're not done with the record. We only got 4 songs. 2 guys got fired. Now we got to go back with our tail between our legs. It's just 2 guitar players, drums, and John, and we have to fucking write a whole bunch of new songs that John does, and we have to arrange them. And son of a bitch, you know, we were not done. And that was like saying, hey, you got to go back to Vietnam.
Right.
And that's
right.
What we did. And,
wow.
And anyway, the record became a number one hit. It gets even crazier. We're in L.A. recording Hurt So Good. just kicking ass. The vice president of the record label comes in, goes, I don't get it. You guys should try to be more like Neil Diamond. John took the guy to the door, kicked him in the ass onto the sidewalk. Needless to say, we got dropped. And then somebody started playing Hurt So Good later on, and it took off like wildfire. And then next thing you know, we're signed again. And we got we're selling records. Everybody's flipping out. We're the newest thing since sliced bread. We got two songs in the top 10 at the same time, Jack and Diane and Hurt So Good. And we are now, that's from that record.
Wow.
I mean, that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
That was a record. Most difficult record I've ever made in my life. And there
so,
it is.
And I'm guessing then, because my next question to you was going to be, well, who's the most difficult person you've ever worked with? And I was going to guess Bob Dylan, because I've seen Bob Dylan deal with his band, and he's pretty tough on him. But from what you just told me, I'm guessing it's going to be Mellencamp.
Well, let's go to Bob Dylan first. Okay. All right, when I made a record with Bob Dylan, right?
Yeah.
And I did Under the Red Sky. And I'm making this record with him. First day, it's with Stevie Ray Vaughan, Jimmy Vaughan, Dave Lindley, Don Was, and I think it was Jamie Mahobrek on keyboard. He's 2 hours late. He comes and taps me on the shoulder. I turn around and goes, "Hey, Kenny, Bob Dylan, nice to meet you." That was the only time we ever talked in the 4 days of making this record. And the 4 days was spread out over maybe 4 months. And it was like every day was a different group of guys except me. I was on every record and every song. And Bob was just, he didn't look like he was happy. So, and I talked about team communication skills, the ability to get along with people. That was an example of communicating by not saying anything.
Wow. And
I just didn't talk to him because I thought he looked like he was in a bad mood. But no, he's always nice to me, and that wasn't the most difficult guy. I'd say John was, because we were like brothers and we spent a lot of time together, and he was very demanding, and I'm not putting him down for it. I'm just saying,
right.
He was tough, man. John was like, you know, shit or get out the pot.
Right.
Come
right.
on, I don't know if that all you got. It was like never, ever good enough.
Yeah.
And it pushed me. So yeah, John was pretty tough to work with, but the whole situation was tough. But man, I was the right guy to go through that. Maybe from trying to please my teachers, trying to please my coaches, trying to please my dad. I don't know. I was the right guy. I was built to do it. Didn't mean it was always fun, but, you know,
yeah.
That's what made me who I am.
Now, has there been an artist or a band that has asked to work with you and you had to say no, and not because of scheduling, because you were kind of like, I don't know if I want to get involved with this?
Nah.
Because you play with everybody. It's unbelievable. Yeah. Whether they're legends or whatever, or brand new the business or whatever, you play with everybody. There's never been anyone like that?
Yeah, never said no to anybody. I've made choices not to be in this band because I'm in that band, because I think that band is a better situation for me. But yeah, you know, I get along with pretty much anybody. I've been on a tour, there was one tour, I won't mention it, where I had to really, you know, put my stake in my ground and said, look, you can talk to other people like that. You can't talk to me like that. I was making records and touring when you were in diapers, and I know more about this business than you do. And you start talking to me, you got it all ass backwards. You work for us. We're the musicians. I don't work for you. You're just a tour manager. You can be replaced.
Right.
Most likely we can't be replaced. So you better get your head out of your ass. You're not talking to me like that. You work for us. You know where I learned that? Mellencamp said that once. I remember back in the day, I thought, God, what a jerk. We're selling out arenas. He said, man, dude, you got to remember, we're the rock stars. They work for us. Don't get too friendly with them. And I thought, man, he's not being really, what an asshole. And then I realized there's some truth to that. What happened in 2005, and I talk about it in my book, shit changed, man. All of a sudden, you know, like, for example, record label, tour managers, people on the road, They didn't tell John what to do, or what he who he should hire, or what clothes he should wear. They tell him, get fucked. You work for us. I'm the fucking guy.
Right.
They wouldn't tell Springsteen that or Elton John that. Hell no. But they sure can tell some of these young bands to tell, you know, when you work for an artist like Katy Perry or Christina Aguilera or
Avril Lavigne. Avril Lavigne, very young when you were working with her, right?
Yeah, but I think she was a band type of person. But maybe the point is, it's up to the artist to say, this is my band. We are this. Now, these other artists I mentioned, I haven't worked with them live, but I have a good feeling. It's all about Katy Perry. Do you know anybody in the band? No. Does it matter? The way they package it, no. So when a big tour manager is out there and they're dealing with sold-out arenas, that person or her assistant is with her and talking to her 24/7, and that person starts to feel like they're more important than the band. And they may even hear from the artist, you know, they see the interaction between the artist and the band, and they may start feeling they're more important because they're making decisions and they're telling the band what to do. Mm-hmm. So they start to feel more important. And I see how it works. Also, everybody in a band like that is disposable. But you're not going to kick Charlie Watts out of the Rolling Stones because Charlie Watts is the Rolling Stones, along with the other guys. It was a band. That's the big difference right there.
Yeah.
And so musicians are way more disposable. We'll go to more modern bands. I mean, you're not going to see, you know, in the band like, what am I thinking? Kings of Leon.
Yeah.
That's a band. Tool, that's a band. Tour managers didn't tell these guys what to do. They tell the tour manager what's going on.
Right.
That's the band I like being in.
And you were in John and Mellencamp's band. Also, are you still a member, like an official member of the Bodines?
Oh, well, the Bodines, I play with the Bodines. Oh, well, Kurt Newman, you know, it's now just Kurt. Kurt's a fucking gentleman. He just tells me, you know, hey, man, do this. He treats me like totally with respect. That's a band. Fogarty.
Yeah.
Pretty much respect. It's his band. He has the vision. But he really honors me, treats me like a king, you know, major respect on tour. You know, he announces me as the world's greatest drummer. I mean, he knows it. I mean, he gets it. Smashing Pumpkins, well, that was a little bit of a different vibe, only because they were going through a lot of stuff. I was a side man. But, you know, at times when people respected me because they knew who I was, and they treated me. I wasn't in the band, but I was treated well. Let me think. What's the name?
Well, that's because you're a valuable commodity. I mean, you're someone who's like guaranteed to get the job done. You're like the you're a rock star, like among the rock stars to me. Like a lot of people may not know who you are or what you look like. They've heard your music. But among the people you play with, everybody like seems to want you to play with them. So you're like the rock star inside the rock star community there.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, it's not bragging. It's just
it's true.
I've done my time. I mean,
yeah.
Esquire magazine did this great article, and the title was genius. I almost had him write my new book, but I. And it went like this: the most famous drummer you've never heard of.
Yeah.
It's like, my mom went, I can't believe that. I says, no, it's perfect.
Yeah.
I am the most famous drummer you've never heard of.
Yeah.
Everybody knows me. They go, oh, there's that guy with the glasses. Oh, yeah, I always see that guy. But I'm not like famous like the guy up front. And you know, that may start changing. I mean, partly why we're talking is the hired gun movie, right?
Right, right. And all the stuff you're talking about and the traveling and the fighting and the dealing with managers, all that's covered in Hired Gun. And there's so many people. I think Rob Zombie put it best in the trailer. He said there's like 20 people who've like made all the music you're hearing on the radio. You know?
Yeah.
And
well, Yeah, there's reasons why people make it, and that's what he's saying. Yeah. Oh, my God, my gorgeous wife just brought me eggs and toast.
Oh.
I love my wife.
You're a lucky man.
So, I am a lucky man. I'm on my third marriage, folks.
There you go.
You know, I wasn't exactly perfect in...
Well, like everything else you've been talking about, you've had to try multiple times, like with the BSO, right? And it's not about luck; it's about it's about discipline.
Well, no, I mean, my dad in the book. I don't know if you remember. I was living in Massachusetts back with my dad, mom, and my dad heard me on the phone. There were no cell phones, of course.
Yeah,
and we were just a couple years after smoke signals. But anyway. So I'm on the phone, and my dad hears me talking to one girl in Boston, another girl in New York, and another girl in Maryland. And obviously, I'm having sex with all three, and he hears me bullshitting all three of them. And he goes, you know, I'll never forget where I was. I was right on Route 7, and he goes, I don't want to tell you how to run your life, because obviously you know what you're doing in music, but man, maybe you should get to know yourself a little bit more before you have all these multiple relationships. Basically, what he's saying is, man, you're fucking up, dude. You're fucking up.
In a very nice way.
And you know what? I remember going, fuck, I don't know what's going on, man. I'm trying to tell him. And you know, the funny thing is, if I was mature and had my shit together, I would have gone, you know, Dad, you're right, but you know, I'm gonna fucking spend the next 35 years kind of doing it my way, and then I'll come back to your way, which is kind of what I did.
Right.
You know? I was living like a rock and roller, like a puppy dog. Yeah, Paul, cool. Yeah, I'll come over here. That sounds good. Yeah, I'll go over there. Yep, that sounds good. Well, what about you told that other guy that you were going to be his favorite puppy dog? Well, yeah, but this guy's kind of fine. He's got a nice fucking steak for me. And, that person over there's got a nice dog bone for me. I was just happy-go-lucky going wherever, you know. And that was kind of... And then finally I went, you know what? I like my wife now, and I was... And I don't want to, I don't want to go anywhere else.
Right.
And it's not always perfect. You know, we yell and fight sometimes.
Right.
We're all going through shit. But guess what, folks? That's what a relationship is.
Right.
You know, finally, I figured it out.
Yeah.
So,
I always say this, you know, being in a band is like a marriage because there's a lot of give and take. There's a lot of compromise. You know, there's fights, you know, there's great love and stuff like that. So. Yeah, and you've had plenty of practice at that, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Oh, yeah.
Hey,
go ahead.
Because we got to wrap it up here soon, but who's left? Who's left that you haven't played with that you really would like to?
Well, the band that I would like to do, I mean, this is without a bass player, but I would love to go, and I played with them. I'd love to go on tour with Sting, with Jeff Beck playing guitar, and on bass it could be holy shit.
Well, Sting's a pretty good bass player. I mean, you know.
Oh, that's right. What am I saying? Yeah, we don't need any bass.
Yeah, he's pretty good.
man, that was good. I fell right into that one. Of course. See, that would be the band.
Wow.
Sting and Jeff Beck. You don't need anybody else.
That would be amazing.
That would be amazing. I mean, Jeff Beck is so badass that when he plays with a singer, I don't even look at the singer.
Yeah.
I mean, everything Jeff Beck does is so brilliant. I'm so blown away by everything he does. His simplicity, his tone, his choice, with his death. So that would be the band.
Wow. Have you ever talked to Sting or Jeff Beck about that?
I was a little bit too humble to mention that to either of those guys. But I think I may have told Jeff Beck one of my dreams is always to play with you.
Wow.
Sting, when I did Kennedy Center Honors and I was upstairs at a party, after party for just, you know, for only invited people, I'm literally holding court with Spielberg and Tom Hanks because Tom loves me. And I did that thing you do.
Oh, that's right. You were in the one-eighters.
Yeah, I was a one-eighter. At least I did the hit, that thing you do. And I'm talking to Tom about that, and Sting comes busting through the crowd of people. It's like a little circle, like a cocktail party, and hugs me and kicks me on the cheek and says, you smoked it. You killed it tonight. He was so. And in my book, you see a picture of me, Sting, and my wife talking about that. I mean, I'm so blown away. I'm like, my head's spinning. Those shows were so intense. And there I'm hanging in a party with Springsteen and Herbie Hancock and Spielberg and Tom Hanks and Sting. And, oh, my gosh.
Yeah, pretty good for a kid from Stockbridge.
Definitely. Yeah. Holy shit.
For a UMass grad. Pretty good, man.
Yeah, I know.
Pretty good. All right. Well, Kenny Aronoff, thank you very much for taking the time. See Kenny in Hired Gun coming out in theaters on June 29th. And I'll get that information up here on the site. And then also Sex, Drums, and Rock and Roll. It's a great read. A lot of great stories. And then you've got another book coming out. When do you think that'll be out?
It'll be out in 2018, probably. And that book is, you know, going to be more a self-help book and how to help people, you know, improve their life no matter where they're at.
Right. And now, I noticed you're at home. You're at home now, I'm assuming.
I'm home right now, I'll be writing my book. I've got sessions coming up. I'm going to go to Europe for 2 weeks with Fogarty. I got Supersonic Blues Machine that I'm playing shows with, which is a band that features. Our second album is going to come out pretty soon. It's like features guitar players like Steve Lukather, Billy Gibbons, Warren Haynes, Robin Ford, Eric Gales, Walter Trout. It's a guitar slinger band. And and then the Bodine's coming up, and I'm a documentary I'm starting with the Kodak, you know, the Kodak film CEO, and I got all kinds of shit.
Yeah,
going
so
on.
Still busy as ever.
We caught you
at a rare moment at home, which is nice.
I'm having a meeting today with that Kodak guy and all kinds of shit.
That's great.
You may see me all over the place. Yeah, we're trying to blow Kenny up.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate you taking the time, you know,
being
at home, and good luck on the new book, and we're looking forward to seeing you in Hired Gun and then coming around the area. And, you know, if you're in the Boston area,
love to have you
up here in the studio.
Listen, I'll come on live anytime in Boston.
That would be fantastic, Kenny, because it's been a real pleasure talking to you, man.
You too, man. Yeah. I love it, man. You're great, man.
Well,
awesome.
I appreciate it.
That's why you're the Kenny Aronoff of radio.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Thank you.
All right. Take care, man.
You too, Kenny. Thanks, man.
Yep. Bye.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app. Thanks to Republic Records.
This is a national contest.